Hello and welcome to another episode of Whiteboard Rugby Podcast, a special edition of The Blind Side, and I'm absolutely delighted to be joined not only by the veritable mastermind that is Sam Lana, but one of my absolute favourite men from what used to be Fleet Street. It isn't Fleet Street anymore, but I suppose we can term it generically as Fleet Street. The man behind the pen that is belongs to Charlie Morgan. It is Charlie Morgan, surprisingly enough. Charlie, great to have you with us. Thank you very much for being with us. It's great to have you along. I should think you're pretty busy at the moment trying to put things down on paper.
Yeah, via a laptop rather than a pen. But yeah, absolutely. Thank you. That's a very humbling intro, and it's brilliant to be here. Thank you.
It was a terrible intro. Anyway, Charlie, thank you very much for being with us. I suppose really a little bit to start with, I suppose it's easiest to sort of set the scene a little bit of how you come to be who you do, because even this weekend, and this is a compliment to you, I had a chap who got in contact with me who pretty regularly in contact with me. He says, "Oh, I love Charlie Morgan's pieces, but they're always behind a paywall." And I said, "Yeah, that's because they're really good." How did you get to be behind a paywall and be really good, Charlie? Tell us how on earth this all happened. Because if you haven't read any Charlie Morgan stuff, A, where have you been? And B, why not, quite frankly? It's pretty good. How did you get to be where you are right now, Charlie? What's the path that you've taken?
Well, it's different for everybody. The paywall bit, I guess, is the easiest bit because that's just where you end up. Some places have paywalls, some don't, more and more so now, which is a debate we can kind of, or a discussion we can get into a bit later, because that is changing in different ways. There's always a bit of luck involved. My dad happened across a phone number for my favourite journalist at the time, who was Ian Stafford, a email address. So I pestered him, and you sending me the kind of title of this podcast made me just think how fast life comes at you, really, because it feels like 5 minutes since I was pestering people about work experience placements and things like that. And now, which is totally bizarre to me, some people are coming to me for advice on how you get started. And the message is basically be as polite as you can, but pester as hard as you can and meld those until somebody gets irritated with you and stops speaking to you. And so Ian was fortunately setting up his own sports website. So I moved to London, stayed with a very generous uncle. He lived near Wimbledon Rugby Club, so I joined them and started playing for them. But there are just snapshots that you remember. And I remember me thinking it was going to be my uncle Julian thinking it was going to be a 2 week placement, and me sort of saying it's kind of it's indefinite, really. It's as long as you can have me. And and that's kind of how I got started. And then I got a job at the RFU, and what tends to happen in their digital department, so just writing up stories for their website essentially, and freelanced out from there. But you tend to be able to, it's kind of a bit like players, I guess, which is kind of a bit pathetic to say out loud, but you measure you can signpost your career by World Cups and Lions tours. So I sort of know where I was in 2011, 2015, 2019 and 2023, and I've been at the same place for the last three of those at the Telegraph. So in a roundabout way, that's how I'm behind a paywall.
Well, I'm not wishing to blow too much more smoke up you, Charlie, but I always think you're absolutely astonishing in kind of what you can pull out of games, but also probably more importantly how you get that across to the audience. And I think there's a lot of people who know a lot about the game and can pick out the analysis bits, but you couldn't understand what they're talking about. And there's a lot of people who write really well but have no interest in analysis. I would say you bridge the gap in a kind of a Venn diagram of maybe one or two people into those two bits. So how do you do that? How do we get more? I guess my bigger question is, how do we get more informed analysis into the wider public?
Geez, big question. Another big compliment as well. Thanks. I'd say my wanting to be so granular about watching games is a lot of it is A, vanity, and B, arse covering. And the vanity bit is I guess I was playing at a level where we were just starting to video our own games, and I got sort of obsessed about just watching stuff back in a sort of, I would like to say it was trying to make myself better, but it was really making sure I hadn't messed up and making sure I was doing stuff that I thought looked all right. And then the arse covering bit was, I give huge credit to Murray Kinsella, because he was doing that sort of stuff before me. And this was where the pestering comes in, was seeing a few of his articles, I think around the 2013 Lions tour, and just saying, how are you doing that? How are you visualizing it? And going from there. I would say I've had a few editors along the way who've taken the mick out of flowery language. I think that's important. I think just being so clear about how you're getting things across probably helps. And then there's also a balance to be struck about how much knowledge you assume and how much you have to lay things out. And I would guess that's kind of what I try to keep in my head a lot of the time. But then I've got a lot of editors who curse me for going over word counts and things like that fairly. And a lot of that sort of added kind of flab is me saying, well, I really want to make sure that people don't think I'm forgetting anything. So that's a constant battle. I think if you're always thinking about how clear can I make this, I think you'll go a long way towards making sure a lot of people will get it and absorb it and maybe benefit from it. But I'm always kind of quite wary of branding myself as an analyst, partly because of the totally amateur way of I was treating my own video analysis, I guess, but then also I just very, very appreciative of how much work the professional guys put in and how detailed they have to be, and also the time constraints they work on and the expectations they have within a professional kind of team environment.
The title I gave you to sort of entice you onto this podcast was around the idea of how it's changed. One of the things that when you're talking about what you're doing there, one of the things that has changed is the medium on which we tend to read or imbibe our articles. And a lot of that is online, which potentially for you gives you more scope, because there's it's easier potentially to operate in the sort of environment that you're doing with, because correct me if I'm wrong, is word count so much of an issue with an online article? I mean, do people say this is going online, so off you go, Charlie, write as much as you want? How does it work?
I wish they did. No, they don't. There still is. But that's a really, really good point. And I guess where it shapes me and how I look at it is I have never necessarily, because I don't know really why, but I never have felt kind of constrained by sort of real, I've never felt that print has so much of a prestige as to be, I never really wanted to be a newspaper journalist. I was never massively passionate about that area of it. And I grew up, as I said, my first job was on a website, and I've always grown up sort of on websites, working on websites, and worked for Telegraph online. And if it could be translated to the paper, that's what we do. And that's now 2015, so however long, 9 years along, geez, 9 years on from that, and now that is the official sort of business
model
approach is we'll make sure something's good for online, and then we'll sort of build the book of the paper on the back from that. Now there's still sort of art to go with the science. Editors are still sort of very skillful editors are still thinking about how page looks and what a splash should be and those things. But I did a newspaper journalism MA at City, but that for me I think was a kind of vehicle to sort of learning shorthand and getting better at doing interviews and things like that, rather than me really being wedded to newspaper journalism. I'm very interested in it, probably far more interested than the sort of average person, I would guess, but and the process of journalism. But I always thought digitally first naturally, because that was, they were just the jobs that, that I had. You're still thinking, you still want to be brief, not brief. You still want to be as concise, clear as possible when you're doing an online article. And yeah, I mean, I've daily file too much. But I will tell you, one story about, and it's actually one of we spoke offline about Jack Zora, absolutely amazing dude. One of his colleagues. One of his colleagues, David Jordan, that when they worked together, at Sportsbeat, David went for to the Times, and I was working, I was on work experience at the Times, or had been seconded there, and did a Friday night, when it was sent on a Friday night to the Stoop for Leicester Quins, and I should have worked out what year it was, but Freddie Burns was playing for Leicester, and I just filed, that was told the word count, and just filed, like, it was, say it was 450 words and filed 800 on the whistle, which is just like dreadful, just like shocking practice. And but my mindset at the time was well, it's, this is really good stuff, so they'll just fit it in. Like, and that's just nuts. Like, to me now, looking back, however many years later, is that is just so poor, so arrogant. So just think about what a good colleague would be, is like no fuss and accurate, and that is the opposite of all of those things. out of a vanity sort of pursuit. So now I try, and when I can stop myself cringing, I do think back to that quite a lot, and just think, when you're on the road at those games, there are still deadlines, there's still print deadlines, and it is really interesting taking people behind the sort of curtain on those, because some of those things are difficult and compromise how you take in the game. But you still have to sort of fulfill those first of all, and then maybe think about, right, okay, is my next tip for online, is that more considered? Is can that, can I go into more detail on that? So yeah, those, it's always and it was sold to me, not sold, it was the opposite of sold to me. I was told that it was kind of going to be a turbulent industry, obviously, and it has proved to be that, but in the best way sometimes, because you're always thinking on your feet and trying to think up different ways of portraying things. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
One thing technology, I think, has definitely gone. Sorry, Sam, just briefly, talk about when GIFs landed with you. when the idea of mini little videos, you must have gone, oh, this is good. I could do so much with this.
Yeah, that was part of Murray. That was part of, I was just asking Murray how he was doing, what he was doing. And yeah, absolutely. But that's the arse covering thing that I'm telling you about, is me knowing that, I know that I can probably be more, I could certainly do more comment pieces. That's just not being a strength of mine. But I think that was because I wanted to sort of show something and say, right, even within that, you've still interpreting it a bit. So there's still a little bit of opinion going on, but I just found a bit more kind of comfortable going, I don't really want a chunk of text to describe this breakdown and somebody just overbalancing a little bit and therefore losing their feet and giving away a really crucial penalty. That's not that good to look at that in a chunk of text. But if you can just show it really briefly, and then have a line to kind of signpost it, that's a better user experience for online. So that, yeah, you're right. That was me looking at Murray's work, to be honest, and going, awesome. Like, that's exactly the kind of thing I want to be doing.
I always think that I, and this is probably an ego thing, I have an idea of trying to kind of an overarching goal of trying to make people understand the game more, because I think they'll enjoy it more if they understand what's going on. Is it any of that part of what you're trying to do, Charlie, or is it simply it just interests you, and if 50% of your leaders go on to learn more about the game, or 100% it doesn't really matter?
God, now I think of it, there's loads of ego on, geez, I think that guy's a good player, I want to showcase how good I think he is, and therefore probably have bragging rights when he does really well next, probably subconsciously. I hope that wouldn't be so far front of my mind, but yeah, that's, I think definitely sometimes with, find it a lot sometimes with, so while I was at the RFU, I don't think this is talking out of turn too much, but Stuart Lancaster was head coach for a little bit, and he gave a media briefing, and I was allowed to go sort of across from the the sort of digital department and watch it. And he gave a briefing to the media where I remember a few things. That it was a presentation on how much New Zealand kicked, because at that point they were kicking more than anybody else, and it was sort of just before that became a sort of cliche. Everybody knows that they kick loads and whatever, and it was how Maranonu had developed in that regard and just made them more dangerous because teams had to sort of think about loads of different threats. And he was sort of saying how important that was. And he was addressing journalists, and I would include myself as I was thinking the same way, I hope, as a journalist in there. And he was saying, right, I'd love you. I know it's not possible, but I'd love you where you can to watch the game back after you've got home and after you've watched it live, because you could maybe think about how many defenders were in the backfield and why we kicked then, or why we went wide more often in that game. And that stuck with me so hard, because it was just, a really interesting way into a lot of articles is, why has a coach done that? Why is a side set up like that? Why have they thought that was a good idea in the moment? So a lot of it is just trying to layer on a little bit that might help. I don't know. Help isn't that maybe patronizing, but just maybe put a little bit more meat on the bones of something that somebody has seen. The first time, I certainly know, yeah, from having watched live games. I was just watching back. I was at Saracen's sale on Saturday and just watching some backwork. Jeez, that happened, did it? Right, okay. I've only written 800 words on the game so far and had no idea. sort of formative things. I remember that really, really well. I remember a lot of what Stuart was talking about really, really well. But there's a lot of reasons. Yeah, and I would say ego certainly plays a part. Just trying to drill into things where you can, I guess.
What's the biggest challenge for you or for your vocation at the moment in terms of where the next hurdle is for rugby journalism? Where do you think it needs to go? What do you think it needs to? Is it on the right course? Is it headed in the right direction? Is it doing what it needs to be doing? Where does it feature for you? You're in the middle of it. You're in the mix of it. So maybe it's an unfair question, but what sort of things are your bosses sort of saying about what they want to see and how they want to see people connecting with the sport?
I think that's a really good, really tough question. I would say that the what I wanted to talk about a little bit sort of links to that. I would say that I've grown up, and I would still count myself as fairly young in the vocation. But
we all are, Charlie. We all are.
Yeah, I am young. Okay, I think that how I've grown up in it is with quite a healthy amount of scrutiny, and maybe more than was in it before. And by that I mean blow the line comments, I mean, and the importance placed on them, I mean Twitter giving you instant feedback on something, whether good or bad, and also more pertinently recently in how editors will have quite sophisticated analytics about a article and how it's done and how it isn't just hits, it's dwell time, it's people subscribing, it's all of those things, it's how people engage with it, share it. I think all of that actually keeps you on your toes quite a lot. And things like the Egg Chasers podcast being around for ages, and also being able to give a really intelligent commentary on news stories, and you're hearing them going, I can riff off that, or geez, that's a good point, or that's what I find that really exciting. And I find packaging up, again, you're always, again, it's a case of always being on your toes, I guess, but finding different ways of packaging it. And I would say that the expectations of somebody that has been in it for the last 15 years has been that we've had to learn how to podcast and do a little bit of video, which totally terrified me at the start, as did podcasts. But I always, and this is kind of what I'm telling the people that are asking about a way into it, is that really good stories told really well, there's a variety of ways to do it, and they will always be valuable, I think. And there are a lot of those. It's a sport that keeps throwing up those all the time, you know, just in the first few weeks of this season. And there are, yes, and then there are also different ways of viewing stuff. So this afternoon, I was looking at a few of the sort of younger wings that have played over the first couple of weeks of the Premiership season, and how in a tight Premiership salary cap, they are more valuable than ever. But then, do you retain them? Do you, you know, where do they play next? I just think that's, I think the more light you shed on it, the more there is bad and good, but there are also a lot more positive stories come out.
I'm potentially going to delve into difficult territory here, Charlie, so apologies if so. But I think one of the challenges I've seen with journalism, because I guess I'm part of it, but apart from it as well in some ways. And I think there's a recent trend perhaps for saying things I just don't believe the person thinks. And I should be obvious, but I don't think you ever do this. But I do think there's significant journalists out there who say stuff which you think you can't possibly actually think that. And one of the things I've always tried to do is, the opinion might be wrong, it might change, but at the time I held it, it was a genuinely held opinion. Do you think that in the era of clicks and controversy driving success and things like that, do you think we're at the risk of basically end up in a situation where we're basically having pub talks or overhearing people in the pubs, but it's on online or it's on podcasts or it's on TV punditry?
I can't think who he's thinking of, really, but that's just me. I can't think.
It's actually not one particular person. It's not one particular person.
Carry on. Sorry, Charlie. Carry on.
There's a chain of how you're writing a lot of the time, and an editor. We've got lots of editors who know their rugby at Telegraph, and they will have opinions that differ to yours, but they will sort of say, "Could you write something on that?" I got asked the other day, really similar question about a piece I'd done on England's inside senses, and they were saying, you can't possibly believe that. And I went, well, I think I do. And I may be sort of putting a theory out there that I believe maybe 75%. Put a bit of mayo gets put on that with the headline, which is quite punchy, which is inviting people to click on it. I'm always really wary of being a clickbait denier. I would love you to click on my stuff, you know, everybody. Yeah. So it's quite, when people sort of accuse me of that, okay, well, yeah, but I'm baiting you a little bit, because absolutely, come and read it and see what you think. I'd say maybe there's that process where somebody throws something out there and they'd be like, oh, well, can we make that a bit stronger? Can we make that a bit harder? And then can you write to that? And then maybe the content of the article will be a little bit softer than the headline. And maybe that's the disconnect that gets a bit tricky. But I would say that you would hope that for people to sort of theorize about anything in any detail and to a standard that would that an editor would want it online, it would have to be pretty well thought out. And then for it to be thought out, it would have to be it would have to be somebody's truth to some degree. I realize I'm massively on the fence there, but there's certainly, I'm just trying to think of stuff. I've certainly sailed close to not having massive conviction in an idea. But I still think it ends up as something that's hopefully thought provoking.
And is that what you're trying to do in a sense of trying to provoke conversation? I mean, that's part of it, isn't it? That's what we want to do. We want to, you know, every time you're trying, even if you don't, you know, you're not quite there, you're trying to get people to chat, because the answer actually may well come back from the people reading it, mightn't it?
Massively. And I've got my best mate in the world is two things that he's ever texted me about my work. It's very rare, but twice he has. Once was I was on the way back from a Worcester Wasps game at the start of the season, and he said, I was on my own on the train just texting him, and he went, aren't you just really lonely, mate? And I was like, yeah, well, yeah, a bit. And then the second And then the second thing he texted me about, well, a bit more sort of a bit nicer, was whenever you just sort of have very aware, I'm from a, my mum and dad are doctors, my little brother's a doctor, and there's four of us. So I'm very aware that I'm not saving lives with what I do. And then sometimes you can sort of talk about that and make a joke about it. And he will say, think about somebody who's on a commute on a train themselves, doesn't have to be back from Worcester, and is just thinking, I've got 10 minutes to read this article, and then I might have a look and see what other people think about it on social media or below the line or whatever. And that's certainly worthwhile. And you would want, there are a lot of articles, I will say, that I have thought, I don't agree with that, and I'm clicking on that because I don't agree with it, and I'll have a look at it. And then I've been swayed, or at least not swayed, but thought. And this is what I mean a bit about the below the line stuff, and actually it being a way that you can develop your own opinions, because you maybe think you've taken that away from a game, and somebody else that you really respect has taken something else, and then you're looking out for that next time, and maybe tempering what you originally thought.
We get a lot. We obviously spoke about paywalls, and I know that obviously that's a constant criticism, which feels bizarre because it's, you know, you are providing a service, and it's mad that you wouldn't get paid for that. I guess there's a lot of people who do it for free, which is probably one of the causes of the issues there. But I guess the only downside to a paywall is that it encourages a lot of people to read this punched up headline, but who won't ever actually go and read the article. And so you can come away. I've had headlines that have been punched up, and I felt, oh, it's so close to not being what I actually think here. And I know that maybe only 40% of the people, like probably less, will actually go and read the article. And I think that can put you in a difficult spot where you end up defending something and pointing people to the article, but you know that realistically they're probably not going to sign up and read it.
Yeah, that's fair. I guess that's part of it a little bit. And to temper that a little bit, though, a lot of the headlines, I think you, in a print world, you could sort of say, hey, I haven't written the headline. A lot of the time you are sort of workshopping the headline with an editor as well now. So if not proposing one yourself. So yeah, that kind of excuse has gone. I guess that's a bit of a trade-off there. But I've also had conversations with clubs about them sort of saying, look, it's unfair for you to write that headline because you're behind a paywall, because therefore that's what the story is in that headline. That's how you should be thinking about it, and you're thinking about it from their point of view. I think that's fair too. It's all part of this. It's just all part of how the media, I guess, kind of wrangles with where we are now.
Have you ever written something or said something about a particular character in the game, only to find them in your orbit in the not too distant future, and therefore have to potentially work around that potential issue? Is there anyone who's read something of yours, player, coach, whatever, got in contact with you and said, actually, I want to chat with you?
Yeah, all the time. But not all the time. Okay, yeah. Some of it's pretty. You're always, if you're a coward like me, I think you're always thinking about those scenarios, those potential scenarios. I think I'm probably allowed to tell this story. So Charlie Walker is a good friend of mine, and I actually asked him once, if I was like, what's it like to defend JJ? Is it like quite hard not to bite in if he sort of takes somebody on the side and takes sort of his opposite man on the outside, and you're on the edge? And I found a clip of Charlie biting in and JJ, putting somebody away. And I was like, can I use that? And he was like, yeah, don't. Please don't. And that was just like a really like little sort of, that was a really explicit sort of, sort of window into sort of how, what you're playing with, I guess. I think, and that's how, just a constant reminder that you've got to be fair and make sure, if, for example, you are writing about Jonathan Joseph's ability to sort of sucking two defenders on the edge, that you're really highlighting that and highlighting how difficult it is to defend that, rather than slamming somebody for making a crap decision.
I think that's one of the big challenges, isn't it? Because there's always a payoff. There's a good thing, and probably the good thing is caused because of a bad thing that the defenders have done, or vice versa. I struggle with that because I want to be positive, and I've been on the receiving end of someone saying, that's nonsense what you've learning about me, and it's fairly tough. Have you, I guess, where do you stand in the positivity versus cheerleading kind of debate about, I guess, I want to be positive about the sport, but I also want to be an objective journalist?
I think that's, yeah, it's just something that you've, I think it's a really, it's something that I try and keep pretty high up my priorities, not being too cheerleadery. I've been accused of, yeah, being, you're accused of both. And if you're accused of doing both, then I think you're doing okay. You know, sometimes like there are loads of writers who'll write a match report and have fans from both teams slagging them off, and you're like, well, great, happy days.
Yeah,
that's probably going to have been pretty measured. But certainly, I don't know whether it's a cynical thing, but you end up the cheerleadery stuff being a bit more damaging than actually than being too hard, because certainly if your yardstick is being fair, you don't want to be a cheerleader. You just want to make sure that you're, because also, but you know, we all know how one of the things you get all the time is when you pick up a young player going, here they are, the English media building someone up to tear them down, and you go, but this guy's really good. Come on, get excited. But that's obviously dangerous for loads of reasons, you know, for the false kind of, you know, not to be so arrogant as to think the player would put any stock in what you're writing, but even just for their sort of own perceptions, I guess, of how things are going.
Final question. I was going to say, it's two-pronged, and you'll obviously know where the second one is when I ask you the first one. What's the worst part of your job?
Oh, geez. There aren't many, and they're pretty first world problems. I'll tell you what, a really niche one. Football journalists
are niche.
Or orbital. So you'll get guys based in Manchester who cover the Manchester clubs, and London cover the London clubs, and you'll have a Midlands correspondent and that sort of thing. It's the time being spent away when from home. But I mean, yeah, smallest violins in the world.
Well, yeah, I know, but you know, Newcastle on a Friday night is pretty tricky. I understand that absolutely. So, what's the best part of your job, Charlie Morgan?
I think the premium that's placed on ideas, and how you can wake up and have an idea and act upon it, and just be that constant feeling that it's on you to be creative about things. I really enjoy, as I've got older and have been in it longer, I think I realize that's quite special, having that creativity, or having creativity being something to lean upon in a job is really quite cool.
Thank you so much, Shirley. The thing that brings me greatest joy about this is there might be one person who's listened to this who isn't previously aware of your work, and they have got a wonderful back catalogue to go and have a look at. Thank you for joining us, but thank you for also everything you do on the bit. It makes the job of other people who want to do analysis a lot easier to kind of following your path. So thanks for sparing us the time, but also sparing us the time over the previous 9 years, I think we decided it was.
That's super kind. Thank you very much.
Top work, Charlie. Thank you. That's it from us on the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast. Until next time, a very goodbye.